There's a ceiling to how high you can build your new home. You can't go up as high as you think you want to. You might be trying to capture a view. You might be trying to create that awesome loft space for your kids to play on the third story, but there's a pretty good chance you can't build it that tall. Many cities and counties have height restrictions, so we're going to dive into our studio and continue on with our Understanding Design Limitations series here, and we're going to learn about heights. That is just one more thing that's putting the squeeze on your lot. And if you know this ahead of time, you're going to be able to design in a very prudent way. So let's go into the studio and check it out. Welcome to the Awakened Homeowner. Thinking about a new home or remodel, but feeling lost in a maze of decisions? You're in the right place. I'm William Reed, and for over three decades, I've coordinated the design and construction of hundreds of remodel and new home projects. I know the process can feel overwhelming, but trust me, you can do this. Here, we break it all down step by step so you can feel confident, empowered, and even excited about your project. No stress, no guesswork, just the guidance you need to bring your dream home to life. Let's dive in. All right, welcome back to the Awakened Homeowner podcast. I'm your host, Bill Reed, your home building coach, and this is episode 37 in our Understanding Design Limitations series. And if you've been following along, we've covered a lot of ground together. We've talked about floor area ratio, which we call FAR in episode 33, which limits how big your home can be relative to your lot. We covered setbacks in episode 34, which creates that invisible box defining where you can build on your lot. Easements in 35, lot coverage in 36. Today we're tackling the vertical squeeze, height restrictions. And think about it this way. If setbacks create walls of your building envelope and lot coverage limits the footprint, height restrictions are basically the ceiling, the lid on that invisible box. And just like all these other rules, it's not as straightforward as you might think. Here's why this one catches people off guard. It sounds simple, right? The city says your house can be 25 feet tall. Done. Easy. Except, where do you start measuring? Where do you stop? Is it from your driveway, the curb, out at the street, the natural grade around your house? And do you measure to the very peak of the roof or somewhere else entirely? I've seen homeowners design beautiful two-story homes, get excited about it, get deep into the process, and then discover they need to cut 2 to 3 feet off the height because the driveway slopes up from the street. That's not a minor adjustment that affects your ceiling heights, your roof pitch, your entire aesthetic. It can really change the feel of the home, believe it or not. By the end of this episode, you'll understand exactly how height is measured in most jurisdictions, why it's not as simple as it sounds, and how to work with your architect to vary compliance early before it becomes an extensive problem. Sound good? Let's dig in. All right, so let's start with the fundamental question. Why do cities even care how tall your house is? Height restrictions are embedded into most municipal codes, and they exist for good reasons, even when they feel frustrating. The primary purpose? To limit the mass and scale of structures in a neighborhood. So keep in mind in our previous episodes, floor area ratio, setbacks, easements, all of these things, in effect, are controlling the mass and scale of your home. And the cities implement all of these rules for exactly that purpose, to protect the neighborhoods. So think about it from the city's perspective. They're trying to protect what makes neighborhoods work. First, there's neighborhood character. They want to prevent one massive structure from dominating a street of modest homes. I've personally lived on streets where I had the Pink Palace next door to me that was towering over my home. You've probably seen this before. Someone builds a huge house that just feels out of place, looming over everything around it. Height restrictions are designed to prevent that. Second, there's light and air. Tall buildings cast shadows. They can block sunlight from reaching your neighbor's yard, their garden, or your neighbor's house could block sunlight reaching your garden, and maybe even their solar panels, for example. And that really matters to people. And then third, privacy. When you add a second or third story, suddenly you can see right into your neighbor's backyard. That creates tension. Fourth, especially in hillside communities, there's view protection. People buy homes in the hills for views, and cities often protect those sight lines. And fifth, even a fire safety component. Taller structures can be harder for firefighters to access and harder to fight fires inside. So the goals are admirable. The challenge is how cities actually measure and enforce these limits. Now, what are typical height limits? They can vary quite a bit, but here's what you'll commonly see. Most suburban residential areas allow somewhere between 25 and 35 feet. And that's pretty standard. Some cities limit by number of stories instead of feet. They'll say two stories maximum, regardless of the actual height. Historic districts often have stricter limits, maybe 25 feet or less, to preserve the character of older neighborhoods. And here's one that catches people. Your HOA, your homeowners association, may impose even more restrictive limits on top of what the city requires. And since these rules and regulations, CC&Rs, design review guidelines, are actually documented and even recorded at the county, you must comply with these HOA rules. And that's why purchasing into an HOA is something that should take serious consideration if you're aspiring to build a new home or remodel an existing home in an HOA. So you really might be dealing with two layers, actually, of height restrictions. The number itself sounds straightforward, 25 feet, 30 feet, 35 feet, got it. But here's where it gets complicated. All right, this is kind of the heart of the episode right here, understanding how height is actually measured, because I promise you, it's not as simple as you think. There are two critical questions you need answered for your specific project. Where does the measurement start and where does it end? Let's tackle the starting point first, because this is where most of the surprises happen. Where does the measurement begin? The starting point for height measurement varies dramatically between jurisdictions, and I do mean dramatically. Even in my area, where I did a lot of design and construction, we had multiple cities in a metropolitan area, the Northern California, Silicon Valley area. And each one of those cities, believe it or not, used similar but not the same methods of calculating and where to measure height. So it's almost like we were reinventing the wheel every time that we would go into a city to understand their rules and submit projects. Some cities use what's called top of curb method. And this is common in urban and suburban areas with paved streets, gutters, and sidewalks, and they measure height from the top of the curb, marked as TC on the survey drawings, up to the roof. And I think in my previous episode about, I think it was easements or setbacks, I had a typical suburban lot and I showed you where the TC is, and the surveyors know that, and they almost automatically mark somewhere on the drawing's top of curb the height above sea level, what the top of the curve is, and that is kind of the benchmark to measure everything off of, even not just the height of the roof, but when you're going to construct the home or do a demolition or rebuild of a home. So now here's the problem with that. If your driveway slopes up, like I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, from the street, you effectively lose usable height. And I have to admit, I had that one project where that caught me off guard. I didn't read the details all the way through to the very, very end, and it was kind of buried in the code. And we end up having to redesign an addition to a home. It wasn't a major dramatic event, but the roof line had to be changed to a different slope in order to partially achieve the goal, and then we had to make some other changes. So lessons learned from 35 years of doing this, and I'll never do that one again. The curb height might be 2, 3, 4 feet lower than the ground level where your house actually sits, and that difference comes right out of your allowable height. So other cities use what's called average finish grade. They calculate the average ground level around the perimeter of your building. Now, in many cases, it's the same all the way around because you're building on a level lot or almost level lot. It's not necessarily that complicated, but if they do calculate from the finish grade around the perimeter, then you're in a little bit better situation than some of the other ones that calculate off height of curb. So this can be the natural grade, what was there before construction, or finish grade after you're done. And it matters which one they use. Some jurisdictions use the lowest point method. They find the lowest ground surface within 5 feet of your building walls and then measure from there. That can really squeeze you on a sloping lot if you've got, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 foot height slope. They're going to make you measure from that lowest point, and that could knock 3 or 4 or 5 feet off your height limitations. And that can affect how you design the buildings. It could be the ceiling heights inside. It could be the roof pitch that you desire that may have to be adjusted. And the reason why I'm bringing all this up today in our Understanding Design Limitations series is because this is precisely where people get into trouble. And even design professionals can sometimes overlook this. And I wouldn't expect so, but it can happen. And then once you go through all of the preliminary design process and you've got a design and 3D renderings and everything that you like, you go into the planning department and they shoot you down. And even worse, sometimes people buy these pre-packaged plans that are all over the internet, and there's some pretty nice ones out there. Problem is they're not designed specifically to the site conditions, so you may end up having to backtrack and modify these drawings that you think you got such a great deal on. And others use an average of four corners approach. They take the natural grade at the four major corners where your structure sits and average those together. Let me just reiterate that project I was working on because it kind of illustrates exactly what matters. This was a typical city suburban lot. It was like, I think it was in the drawings, I think it was 80 feet by 100 feet or something. So it was around 8,000 square foot lot with curbs and gutters. And the driveway sloped up from the street. The city had a 25 foot height limitation measured from the top of the curb. And in this particular case, of course, the roof was like a 12 and 12 pitch, which means it's a very steep slope. So you can kind of do the math. If the height limit is 25 feet, and it was a two-story home, if the height limit is 25 feet from the curb, but the ground around the house is already 2.5 feet higher than the curb, the actual height from the adjacent grade where you actually are standing next to the house had to be limited to like 22 feet or 22.5 feet for a two-story home. That suddenly affected everything. Ceiling heights got compressed, roof slopes got lower, and the whole design kind of had to be reworked to 2.5 feet. And that's all it was, and it changed everything about that project. And I just want to mention one other thing that's sort of unrelated to height limitations, but it had to do with the steep roof I mentioned earlier. So it's a two-story home with a steep roof. And because that roof was so steep, a certain part of the attic space, believe this or not, was so high, anything under 8 feet high, when you measure you were up in the attic and you were measuring from the top of your floor joists up 8 feet, that particular area had to count towards the floor area ratio, even though it wasn't occupied. So that limited how big of an addition we were able to do on the home. So this is the crazy stuff you see out there. And this is why the mission of the Awakened Homeowner is to learn from some of these wisdom-gaining experiences, I call it. You could also call them mistakes. But here's another one. Where does the measurement end? So we've talked about where it begins. Is it at the curb? Is it around the perimeter? Is it an average? So that's where we start measuring, but where does it end? This depends heavily on your roof type, and this is where roof pitch becomes really important. For flat roofs, it's pretty straightforward. You measure the highest point of the roof surface or to the top of any parapet wall. Those are the walls that are sticking up, and then you look over them and you can see the flat roof behind them. So you're measuring to the top of those parapet walls. But for pitched roofs, gable roofs, hip roofs, gambrel roofs, here's where it gets interesting. Many jurisdictions don't measure to the peak of the roof. They measure to the midpoint between the eaves and the ridge. So think about that. If your roof peak is at 30 feet, but the eaves are at 20 feet, the midpoint is 25 feet. That's what counts for height limit in many cities. That can actually work in your favor if you understand it up front. Mansard roofs are typically measured to the deck line, which is that flat portion at the top. Now, here's something most homeowners don't realize. Your roof pitch directly affects how tall your roof peak will be, even if the walls are the same height. So a steeper roof pitch, like I mentioned earlier, such as a 12 and 12, a 12 and 12 means for every 12 inches of horizontal run, it goes up 12 inches. And then you can just extrapolate that out. And that's a 45 degree. That's an extremely steep roof, which means that ridge, the very top of the roof, is going to be a lot higher than a 4 and 12 pitch, which is rising 4 inches for every 12 inches. And that's a common roof pitch that you see in many houses. 12 and 12 gets into the more grander, more traditional style homes. If your city measures to the absolute peak, that steep architectural roof you love might push you right over the limit. And don't forget about the floor area ratio calculation. Knowing that and going in ahead of time can really be a smart approach, because you may go with an 8 and 12 pitch roof. And this is all part of what your architect is doing. And let's keep in mind, most of what I'm talking about today in understanding design limitations is what a professional architect and design team does at the very beginning, before they even design anything, is they research all of this. I'm bringing this to your attention so that you as a homeowner can monitor this and make sure that you're aware of these conditions and these limitations, so that you can ask the right questions and you can make sure that you don't lose time on your projects. You're not getting charged for design time because the planning department shot down the project, and come to find out it's because we weren't following the rules to begin with. That's the biggest mistake that you can make in working with the city planning and building departments, is trying to not follow the rules. So does your city measure to the peak or to the midpoint? It makes a real difference in what you can design. Now, if you're building on a sloping lot, all of this gets really a lot more complicated. If you're building on a slope and a lot of desirable properties are on slopes, height calculations become a whole different animal. Ground level becomes like a moving target. Many cities have developed specific rules to handle sloping lots. They might require stepped designs that allow the natural contours of the land to influence the design. Instead of one big box, your house steps down the hillside. Height might be measured at multiple points along the building, not just one spot. Some jurisdictions say you can't exceed the height limit at any point along your exterior walls. So even if the average works out, if one corner is too tall, you've got a problem. Hilltop properties often have even stricter limits, actually. And cities don't want buildings protruding against the skyline, so they'll cap heights specifically to prevent that. And then there are view protection overlays in some communities. If someone uphill from you has protected views, your building height might be restricted specifically to preserve their sight lines. And I've personally dealt with this in a project in Northern California. They called that particular city, called it the View Shed Program. There's a qualification process to see if the project qualified for that scrutinizing plan, and it didn't actually. But in the process, I was able to learn about what the View Shed Protection Program is, and it's quite restrictive. So this is something that you're going to want to be aware of, and early on in the design process, because there's nothing worse than going through a whole design and then again the planning department saying, well, have you followed the View Shed Program? And big blank stare comes out of everybody's eyes and you are devastated because you have to redesign to a certain level. So beyond slope issues, there are other restrictions that can layer on top of the basic zoning height limit. Your HOA might have its own height restrictions that are more restrictive than the city's. I've seen communities where the city allows 35 feet, but the HOA caps it at 28 feet. You have to comply with both. Historic districts often limit height to match the existing neighborhood character. If the homes around you were built in, you know, the late 1920s at 22 feet, that might be your limit too. And why the historical aspect is important is if you were to just generally go through the municipal code to look at your particular zoning height restrictions and don't dig further to see if you're in a historical district. Your home may not be classified historical, but you might be in a historical district, which means all of the homes have another layer of rules on top of them. And some cities have step back requirements for upper floors, which kind of crosses over back into the setback requirements. Your first floor might be allowed at 5-foot setback, but your second floor has to be set back 7 or 8 feet from the property line. That affects the overall envelope of what you can build. The point is, never assume the basic zoning height limit is the only constraint you'll face. There can be multiple layers. So what does all this mean for your actual design? So here's what most homeowners don't realize until they're deep in the design process. Height restrictions don't just affect the outside of your home. They dictate what happens inside. When you're squeezed on height, something else has to give. Those 9-foot ceilings you wanted maybe on the main floor, they might become 8-foot ceilings. That beautiful vaulted great room, it might need to be reduced or eliminated entirely. That steep, dramatic roof pitch that gives the house character, you might have to flatten it out to stay under the limit. That's probably an extreme example, but even the floor structure matters. Your second floor has joists, subfloor, and finished flooring. That might be 12 to 14 inches right there. Every inch adds up when you're trying to fit two stories under a height limit. And here's where it all comes together. Remember back in episode 33, we talked about how FAR, floor area ratio, limits your total square footage. And in episode 34, we covered how setbacks create that horizontal boundaries of where you can build. Add height restrictions into the mix, and you can see how your city really controls the design of your home. FAR limits total square footage. Setbacks limit horizontal footprint. Height limits the vertical expansion. Put them all together and they define your complete building envelope. That invisible three-dimensional box where your home has to fit. So understanding all of these restrictions before you start designing is absolutely critical to setting realistic expectations. And that is what the mission of the Awakened Homeowner is in this first year of podcasting, is heavy focus on planning way before the design even begins. And we'll get into that in a little bit later when you're actually beginning your design. This is where you are going to eliminate a lot of problems that you hear about, a lot of the challenges that you're hearing your friends and colleagues face, and to empower yourself to be able to know what to ask for, what to look out for, to make sure that you are protecting yourself and your pocketbook. So if you go into the process not knowing these constraints, you're setting yourself up for disappointment or worse, expensive redesigns. And even worse than that, somehow you got through the planning department and then the neighbor calls and says, this building seems really high. And then all of a sudden people investigate and sure enough, it's 5 feet too high. Even though the city may have approved it, guess who pays the price? You do, which doesn't seem fair, does it? So how do you navigate all of this? So let's get down to it and the infamous The Awakened Homeowner Action Plan. So here's your action plan. 5 steps to avoid height restrictions trap. So here's your action plan. 5 steps to avoid the height restriction trap. Step 1, research your specific city or county height measurement methodology. Don't assume. Get the municipal code and read exactly how they define building height. From where to where? Is it curb? Is it average grade? Is it the peak or the midpoint? Get specific. And if you're a design professional or aspiring design professional or a design build company where you have in-house designers, these episodes are going to help you as well. Because in many design build outfits, some of the design team are not necessarily licensed architects. They may be residential designers. And this is a great resource to educate you all on some of these nitty-gritty details that people get burned on daily. Step two, get a professional survey early. Again, there I go with the survey thing. Your surveyor can establish grade elevations, identify the curb height relative to your lot, document the topography, the sloping of the lot. This is the foundation data that you need for accurate height calculations. And we talked about this all the way back in episode 14 with the land surveyor. And this is exactly why that matters. And then down the road, I'm going to get into more details on what the survey drawings look like and how a civil engineer would use that on a larger scale project. Step three. Have your architect verify height compliance during the schematic design. That's the design step one that we covered back in the design process series. And even before that, actually, in what sometimes we call the discovery stage, which is even before design occurs, really vet out all of that criteria ahead of time. Don't wait until you're deep into detailed drawings and discover you've got a problem. Step four, check again during design development. Rooms grow during design. Roof pitches change, ceiling heights get adjusted as you refine the plans. Re-verify height compliance every time the design evolves significantly. This is a big one because once you get in the heat of the moment and you're designing and you're having a great time, the synergy is there, things are being decided, changes are being made, ideas are being discovered, walls are getting moved, rooms are getting added, ceiling heights are getting increased, adding a loft in this area. You can see that this can kind of put a veil over what is really important is making sure that the rules are still being followed, even though you may have understood the rules 4 months ago when you first researched them. All of that excitement can sometimes cloud over, and sometimes people forget to go back and revisit the rules. So during the design development phase, which is step two of the design process, which becomes a lot more regimented process. So the further you go into the design process, the deeper you're getting, the less that changes are possible, or I should say reasonably possible. So this is a really important part of the action plan, is verify during the design development process that you still are on track with the rules. And then step five, you know, get written confirmation from the planning department before you submit for permits. Verbal interpretation can often be wrong, especially if you don't have the fully qualified person behind the counter at the planning department. Remember, back in the design process series, one of the smartest things you can do as a homeowner or as a design professional is to visit with the planning department. Learn everything you can online, because most of it is there. But there's still little hidden little tidbits of information that are sometimes hard to uncover. Visit with the planning department, schedule an appointment with one of the planners, and go in and have a discussion about the property and make sure that you've got your butt covered as best you can. And sometimes even that's not enough, but that is way better than making a lot of assumptions, not looking closely at the municipal code, not looking closely at the homeowners association design review guidelines. This is a really smart thing to do. And, you know, make a note, make notes, have them show you in the municipal code where all the rules and regulations are. Ask those questions like, are there any other rules? Are there any other overlays in my neighborhood? Use that word, overlays, in my neighborhood that would affect what I can design on my property. And I've done that before, and sometimes you see the little spark in the, oh, let me check. And then sure enough, there's, you know, overlays. Sometimes they did not apply to my project, but there are overlays in certain neighborhoods, historical overlays, for example. So these are the five steps that will save you from discovering height problems when it's too late to fix them easily. All right, so let's wrap this up. So here's what we've covered today. Height restrictions limit the vertical dimension of your building envelope. The tricky part isn't the number, it's how it's measured. Where you start measuring, is it the curb, the grade, the corners, and where you end that measurement, the peak, the midpoint, the deck line of like a mansard roof. And it varies by jurisdiction. So just because you may have done a project in another neighboring city doesn't mean it's the same in this city. There's really no universal standard, and when you're squeezed in height, it directly impacts your interior ceiling heights, potentially, your roof design, and your overall aesthetic. So the key takeaway, where you measure from matters just as much as what you measure to. Verify height compliance at every design checkpoint. So everything we covered today about height restrictions is within section 2.307 of the Awakened Homeowner book. And like I've said before, the podcast here is my opportunity to expand on that information and give you in my own voice to elaborate on and expand on and give you kinds of the ins and the outs. But the Awakened Homeowner book is a really good resource for you to have by your side. You can read through it, and it's a pretty good sized book. There it is, Awakened Homeowner. And of course, it's available on Amazon. That's my shameless plug. But I'd love to hear from you too. Have you run into height restriction surprises on your project? Did you have to reduce ceiling heights or change your roof design to comply? Send me a message at www.reed@theawakenedhomeowner.com. Or find me on Instagram at The Awakened Homeowner. And if this episode helped clarify height restrictions for you, please take 30 seconds to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or subscribe at YouTube and give me a thumbs up. They help. When you do that in these platforms, it helps other homeowners see this content that may be in the same boat that you're in. And I'd like to read those comments, and I would reply. And if you have questions, you can shoot them in there too. All right, everyone. That's what I had for you today as part of the Understanding Design Limitations series. I'm Bill Reed, your home building coach. Remember, enlighten, empower, and protect. That's what we do here. Thanks for listening, and let's make it happen. All right, quick reminder, everybody. Everything we're talking about today and so much more is in the Awakened Homeowner book. At less than 0.1% of your project cost, it's the best investment you'll make. Grab your copy on Amazon and keep it by your side throughout your entire project. Trust me, you'll refer to it again and again. Thanks for tuning into The Awakened Homeowner. Remember, you've got the power to take control of your project from day one. If you're ready to dive deeper, grab The Awakened Homeowner book on Amazon. It's your roadmap to success. Join our community at theawakenedhomeowner.com and download our free story, The Tale of Two Homeowners. And here's something exciting. I'm developing an app called BuildQuest that's going to revolutionize how you plan and manage your project. Visit buildquest.co to become a founding member and test drive the app when it launches. Follow us on social media and hit that subscribe button. All the links are in the show notes and bio. Got questions? I'd love to hear from you. This is Bill Reed. You got this.